Look, basically, I've got a body of work now. There's various parts of it. I'm principally going to address the South African part of it because this is a really good opportunity for me to do that. I've never actually had that opportunity before in an academic context, aside from two African studies conferences in Australia before. It's good that Ivor's here and it's in this place because actually one of the few places where I did present anything related to South Africa was actually in Heat magazine. I wrote an introduction to the poems of Tatankulu Africa, which was published here. I also wrote a review, now this is going back many years ago, of Eynkie Krog's book about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which also appeared in Heat. So I feel at least partly sure of where I am. I'd just like to begin with a few things, but before I start, I'd like to introduce a proverb as a kind of like a forewarning and hopefully as a kind of an amulet for my presentation. It's a proverb, an Armenian proverb. It says, give the man who tells the truth a horse so that he can leave on it before they kill him. Okay? I'd also like to echo a lot of things that, that were said before, especially about words, of course, and that'll be throughout the piece. But one of them is just to say, well, I feel very uncomfortable with the idea of white, being called white, for a whole series of reasons that would take up 15 minutes, probably. So I'd like to just say, like, how sure are we that we should use the word white? To me, white, when people say white people, I just think of ghosts. I don't think of people. How sure are we when we say settlers? I mean, Ingrid already mentioned that. I mean, I'm not sure I relate to that. When we say indigenous, and I know very much from the context of talking with South African artists who've been to Australia, they find this idea of indigenous, the indigenous collection, very strange and possibly racist. But I think they're wrong in that. But just the idea of indigenous, I think we should signal as a category that needs to be rethought or questioned or considered. And then the idea of English, you know, sometimes I'm called like an English person because I speak English, like in Spain, they go, the English. I'm not English, okay? So yeah, as I said, like this is an opportunity for me to think through a whole lot of things, and part of them relate to the work I've written about Australia as much as the work I've written about South Africa. Now, remember when I came to Australia, this was just before the end of apartheid. I witnessed these things from afar, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Mandela being elected, Mandela being released. Some of this is in my work. I also, and this is something that needs to be thought of in relation to South Africans in Australia, started to investigate Australian history because really we didn't know what it was about when we came here. One of the peculiar coincidences that occurred for me early on was actually being at the Bringing Them Home Report presentation in Sydney on my first trip to Sydney. And to try to reconcile that with meeting Mudruru Narajan, as he called himself, and seeing some of the writings he had done in Western Australia at that point in time, and seeing something like that, seeing Mabo being decided in relation to my experience of South Africa, it's sort of hard to articulate what that means. But to me, they were part of similar kinds of restitution or questioning or politicking or whatever. And then I did make some attempts to sort of present South African work within Australia, as I mentioned in Heat magazine. I also did a supplement for Slope many, many years ago, which I don't know how many people saw, of new African poetry, but South Africa was quite an important part of it because it came out of being at a poetry festival in Durban. I also wrote an essay on Brayton Breytenbach, which met with sort of no response at all, and someone from Melbourne Uni in a review said, oh, there's an interesting essay in this issue of Westerly about someone we probably don't know of, Brayton Breytenbach, who, like, to me, is probably, I mean, until Coetzee, the most famous South African poet. Then later on, I mean, more or less, the South Africanness was fading. I was invited to read at the South African Embassy in Canberra. To celebrate the 10th year of the election. And I was a little bit anxious about that because, you know, like, how South African am I? Who knows? And so I thought, oh, well, I'll just go and, you know, if it ends badly, I can write a poem about it, you know. And so I read a poem that I had read in Durban, and I will read now, which was a poem that sort of provokes responses, as sometimes my poems do, and makes anxieties. And I try to be pleasant, but the poems make people anxious, and I'm too old to worry about that now. So I thought, look, I'll just read this poem, and if they hate it at the embassy, then I'll just not go there again. But it wasn't to be the case. But when I read it in Durban, Einki said a few things about it afterwards, which I'll mention. But let me read the poem first. It's called An African City. And for those of you who are interested in looking it up on the net, I wrote a short essay which appeared in Slope about this poem, which was an account of me returning to Johannesburg in 1995. And it echoes things that I was told about Johannesburg. For those of you who know Johannesburg, the central part of the poem is talking about Hillbrow, and then the later part of the poem is talking about a place called Krugersdorp, where my aunt and uncle live, which is mentioned. And Krugersdorp is a sort of a suburb in the west along the Rand, but quite far away. It was originally a sort of separate town. And Hillbrow's in the center of Johannesburg. It's kind of like a really intense urban environment with high rises now. An African city. They tell me Joburg's just awful, full of blacks. An African city, dangerous. They tell me Nigerians and Colombians there are selling cocaine, brewing crack, ruining lives. They tell me they're also Senegalese, having prayer meetings, and Angolans speaking like poras, and Mozambicans selling AKs and pistols, and so-called Swazi princesses caught in the act their tenants think is moss flesh. Flesh is yet meat. They tell me causes are slaughter in the pondo. They tell me in a foundry shots ricochet of fire. They tell me they can hear I live in a place called Aussie. They tell me, and I hear them, the playgrounds are full of children, and the sheer faces of huge blocks of flats have windows like names all over a war memorial. If flesh is yet meat, are we carnivores, murderers, cannibals yet? In Krugersdorp, in my aunt and uncle's garden, I see the ghost demon scene when I grew like a fingernail and dust from mine dumps coated our furniture and floor with forensic yellow. And that man cupped his hand to his ear. My voice, echo. As I said, ghosts, maybe not a white ghost. Now, if we want to talk about craft and these matters, I mean, in a poem like that, at that point in time that I was working on it, I was very much looking at African poetry, modern African poetry, black African poetry, not always from South Africa. I was interested in parallelism. I was interested in the storytelling dynamic of it, all these different things. But the thing that struck me is I was always trying to, at that point, I was sort of thinking of how to write a poem about Johannesburg, a city where the actual streetscape was entirely structured by apartheid. You know, the city was divided into basically two different cities. There was segregation. And then at the end of that, the whole cityscape changed. And what was the center of the city became basically a center of the city for black South Africans and others from other parts of Africa, but not for the whites. And so this circling of all their descriptions is the circling of not going into the city. You know, recently someone said to me, did you live in the center of the city in Johannesburg? Well, it's not like that, you know, like it's quite segregated now still. And so they've rebuilt another city, Sandton, which has become the center of commerce now. So really what I'm interested to sort of articulate is just, in a sense, this quality of how language lives on with racism, with prejudice, with all these negative articulations as normal language that isn't maybe poetic, that isn't recordable, but that it can be restructured in another way. And for me, this is key to Johannesburg. It's an aggressive city. It's full of unpleasantness as well as good things. And when I was looking through poems that had been written previously about Johannesburg, I mean, two really struck me, and I don't think there's many others that I would compare to these two. There's a poem, I couldn't check it, the title before I came, but I think it's called Joburg City, Johannesburg by Mongani Sarotti, a kind of a classic poem about Johannesburg that also works through a whole series of repetitions and actually works through this idea of a gesture, which Ingrid mentioned, but the gesture is of patting his back pocket to check where he hid the money so that he won't be robbed on the train going home. Very Johannesburg gesture, you could say. The other poem is a poem that I discovered through Stephen Gray's anthology, the Penguin Anthology of South African Verse, I think it was called, which is called Quela for Tomorrow by a Portuguese poet called Rui Knopfli. And I want to introduce this because these two poems, which are kind of models for that poem, are actually poems that have relations to other languages. The one, the Knopfli, is an English translation from Portuguese. The poem by Sarotti is in English, written in English, but there are interviews where Sarotti explains like the language situation that he grew up within, where actually several languages were in operation. And I think, if I recall correctly, I read it a long time ago, that his parents didn't actually speak the same first language. So they were actually communicating second and third languages as the romance of the romantic language. And so actually to think of him writing in English, I think we should really, again, question, like, to what extent is it written in English, or is it written in something that's interlingual? And this is very, very interesting to me and something that I follow up in other parts of my work. And it's important in the South African work because I think the quality that I find in South African English is actually an Afrikaans grammatical quality that underwrites colloquial South African English, but not formal South African English. And so much that you encounter that's written, especially in prose, has been formalized to make it less messy than it actually is. And actually, I think poets are often looking for this kind of messiness, and especially poets who want to speak in the colloquial in a kind of a Creole or something like that. And over the years, I was very interested in this question, like, where is the interlingual? Where are these fossilizations of grammar? Where do they appear or disappear, or are they negated? How readable is a poem that's written in South African English in another English language context? The other thing with this poem that I must remark on, which might sound a bit strange, and I know when I spoke at the Academy of Advanced African Studies in Bayreuth recently, it certainly sounded strange there, but I said, I think we have to think about the spirit world. I know we were talking in the car about the folklore and that, but I think we have to think about the spirit world, because maybe the spirit world brings together connections across countries, across languages that are actually not visible on another register. And in a sense, I think Bishop Tutu is a very interesting example of this, because his presentation registers across spiritualities, if you like, within South Africa. But obviously his position is as a distinct public figure, but an emotive public figure, which maybe the other figures weren't allowed to be in the same way. Yeah? Look, there's a lot of other things I can say. It's 5 minutes. Okay, look, I'll just skip over. I would like to address the question of Afrikaans, but we don't have time. But this is something that's really key to thinking through this dynamic between English and other languages within South Africa. I'll also just signal, you know, like, this work and these thoughts led to my writing a sequence of poems about the Australian circumstance, which I think is to do with the question of Aboriginal languages within place and how to encounter that. Again, a very complicated issue, but for those of you who don't know my work, in the book The West, all of those poems are collected under a section called Mukari's Ear, and there is a text that I wrote as a kind of oblique commentary on it called Nativism and the Interlocutor that has appeared in Jacket a few months ago, I think, or last year. if we only have 5 minutes, look, let me just say, I think the other issue is that one of the problems, I think, for me here is I think we're very much talking about English. And I think in the context of South Africa, you're very much aware of a multilingual circumstance in which English has priority, okay? But I think in terms of a poetic and an imaginary, I'm quite interested in this position of like, what are the relationships to the other language? Like for me, Knopfi can write things about Johannesburg that other people didn't write about Johannesburg. And it's partly because he's writing in Portuguese within a Portuguese tradition, within a Portuguese sense of cosmopolitanism, and also an awareness of Portuguese colonialism that allows him to see Johannesburg as Paris, which is the title of one of his poems. Okay, which Johannesburg people couldn't see. Okay. So I'll just conclude with a last poem, with a poem which is from the book published by Giramondo. The book's called Southern Barbarians. The Portuguese didn't like it. They thought they were the barbarians. I said, oh, how can you be so sure? There's other candidates. So they wanted to call it Namban, which is the Japanese name given to the Portuguese, which also means Southern Barbarians, but it's Japanese. So this is a poem about an Angolan historian, Ana Paula Travais. It's set in Coimbra, which is the university city in the middle of Portugal. I'll just sketch it because it refers quite specifically to the place, so it might be a little bit difficult to visualize or if you miss one or two words. But basically it's talking about being in Coimbra, which is an old city. And then it refers to being in Lisbon, but it also refers at the end to when Ana Paula Travais was in Durban, also for the poetry festival, and she talks about something she saw there. The very last words are in Portuguese. They just mean, young lady, excuse me. We were walking along the Rua do Arco de Triassal, just below Coimbra University, on our way to the botanical garden, deep in conversation about Leopold Senghor and the vanity of power. Poor fellow, we agreed. Few love his poems now. We read our poems under a Moreton Bay fig tree, and neither of us could have ever imagined that. That weekend, all we discussed were the subtleties of Portuguese cuisine, tripas ao molho do Porto, tarta da amendoa, and the vast empire of bacalhau. You were an Angolan mother to me, you who are an historian and poet. In Lisbon, too, we spoke about food and at the table. I remember my coconut curry with the white rice and your chicken sputtering over a brazier out in the bright Dalfalma street. You were saying that when in Durban, strolling along the foreshore, you and a friend were overheard by a white man whose job was weaving telephone wire into baskets nimbly, like a proper African. And he had said, I can understand your language. I learned when I was fighting you people in the war. You made no comment, no words of disabuse, were gentle in your recollecting, just as you had been in asking directions to the restaurant. Maninha. Desculpe. That's it? Okay.